This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the first weekend of February 2020. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. New data showing Black and Hispanic drivers are increasingly more likely to be stopped by Austin police.
The data really wasn't a surprise. It was more a confirmation of something that we already knew was happening.
The story of a Central Texas man's deportation to Mexico and how it affected his children, who are U.S. citizens.
Every time your dad or your mother drives away, that might be the last time you see them. It's not hard to imagine how damaging that can be for a child.
And the Austin History Center celebrating a newspaper that's chronicled Black life in Austin since 1973.
We want to record the positive thing about African-American community.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend.
All right, good morning, everybody. My name is Farah Muscadin, F-A-R-A-H.
Farah Muscadin is the director of Austin's Office of Police Oversight, and this is sound from a news conference this week that was held to talk about a report on racial profiling as it relates to traffic stops by police. This report looked at data over several years, from 2015 to 2018.
And what is important to take away from this report is the disproportionality of stops, arrests, and searches as it relates to African Americans and Latinx members of our community.
And social justice groups are reacting to this. Paulette Blanc is with Measure, an Austin-based nonprofit focused on using data to analyze racial disparities.
I think as a community, or really being part of the Black community, you've kind of lived these experiences, and this really speaks to those experiences. So the data really wasn't more a surprise. It was more a confirmation that of something that we already knew what was happening, but now other community members can kind of have this common language to kind of have that dialogue with us.
So let's dive into this report and take a closer look at what the data tells us about policing in Austin. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey has been reporting on this. Hello, Audrey.
Hi, Nathan.
First of all, can you give us some context for this report? Where did the information, where did the data come from?
So the data for this came from APD, from the Austin Police Department. And APD actually puts out yearly its own racial disparity report, looking at the race and ethnicity of people that it stops. And so we kind of already had this data, but we hadn't really looked at it in aggregate before. And that's what the Office of Police Oversight, the Innovation Office, and the Office of Equity did with this report.
What does this report say about Black and Hispanic drivers being increasingly more likely to be stopped by Austin police?
From 2015 to 2018, Black people stopped by police were overrepresented in regards to their population. And what I mean by that is Black people make up roughly 8% of Austin's population, but in 2018, they made up roughly 15% of people pulled over by police. And then when we look at the number of those vehicle stops that resulted in arrests, Black people made up 25% of that. Again, Black people are 8% of Austin's population. While there was a smaller disparity when we look at Hispanic and Latinx people, we still saw that presence. So in 2015, the number of vehicle stops of Hispanic and Latinx people was actually representative of their population in Austin, about roughly 31%. But over time, that's ticked up a little bit so that we're now seeing 33% of the people stopped by police are Hispanic or Latinx, which is roughly about 2% higher than their overall population makeup.
Does the report say why?
It does not. And that's, you know, the big question here. And that's the question that Police Chief Manley had when I talked to him. He acknowledged that because APD has been putting out their own reports on this year over year, that they know this disparity exists. And he really wants to figure out why.
Are these occurring from instances where officers have discretion and therefore bias may be present? Or are there other factors? And an example would be the data that talks about arrests from traffic stops and the disparities that exist in those numbers when you look at sheer population. But what we don't know yet, because it requires further analysis, is what was the reason for that arrest? In other words, how many individuals across all ethnicities were arrested based on warrants versus how many were arrested because the officer was exercising discretion?
What's interesting in this report is that it does look at what they call high and low level discretion searches. So these are cases where someone's pulled over by the police and they have a certain level of discretion, meaning they may or may not be obligated by law to search that person's vehicle or their belongings. In cases where they had a high level of discretion, meaning that it was really up to them whether or not they wanted to search, more than other races, Black people were more likely to be searched when an officer had more discretion.
What kind of recommendations does this report suggest to address the disparities it identified?
One of the recommendations that the police department actually agrees with is that this data should be looked at on an officer-by-officer basis, and that officers who appear to be over-policing certain racial groups more than others should be flagged. Chief Manley told me that they currently have a database to flag officers who appear to be using use of force more often than other officers, but it doesn't drill down into race. And so that's something that the report authors recommended and that the police department also would like to see.
Hasn't APD already faced accusations of racism at the highest levels?
Right. So this report comes at an interesting time for APD. In November, we learned that a recently retired assistant chief had been accused of alleged racism, of using a racist term for Black people numerous times. And the city responded by hiring an investigator to look into that specific incident. And then in addition, city council members voted for a department-wide investigation looking into bigotry as a whole and, you know, including an audit of police officers' use of social media.
KUT's Audrey McGlinchey, you can read her reporting on this at KUT.org. Thank you, Audrey.
Thanks, Nathan.
With a growing number of confirmed cases of the coronavirus, the University of Texas at Austin is trying to control the spread by restricting students, faculty, and staff from traveling to China. KUT's Sankita Menon has more.
UT Austin has added China to its list of high-risk travel areas. The university is suspending undergraduate student travel to China. Students enrolled in international programs there will be relocated to a program in another country or attend classes in Austin. Faculty, staff, and graduate students, however, may still be allowed to travel to China for work the university considers essential. The university has specifically placed the city of Wuhan in the Hubei province of China on its extreme risk travel list. That's where the virus was first identified. The university says it will continue to monitor the outbreak through trusted authorities, including the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the U.S. State Department. Sangeeta Menon, KUT News.
The United States Department of Agriculture has approved the Texas plan for governing the sale and production of hemp. That's the fibrous, non-psychoactive form of marijuana. KUT's Jerry Quijano has more.
Last year, the Texas legislature legalized hemp, and when they did that, basically what they were doing was saying, we don't want to follow the USDA rules. We want to establish our own rules. So when the USDA released their plan last year, Texas was already working on theirs and sent it for approval. Now it has been approved, but that doesn't mean that people can immediately start growing hemp. In fact, in a statement released on Monday, Ag Commissioner Sid Miller said it's still not legal to grow hemp, so don't put the seeds in the ground just yet. He says they still need to work on things like the licensing program, but the state is almost there.
KUT's Jerry Quijano. To fight climate change, City of Austin operations are supposed to stop adding CO2 to the atmosphere by the end of this year. The city also has the goal of making the whole Austin community carbon neutral by 2050. KUT's Mose Bushell reports there's a long way to go to meet that second goal.
That was the takeaway from a city audit released this week. It says that first goal should be achievable through the purchase of carbon credits at the end of this year. But for the whole city, that's residents, businesses, etc., to go carbon neutral, Austin needs to tackle transportation-related emissions. That means getting more people to commute less, take transit, share rides, and use electric vehicles. Kelsey Thompson was the auditor in charge.
Several peer cities have electric vehicle promotion efforts that Austin is not currently doing, such as offering rebates for buying electric vehicles or establishing an ordinance that requires new parking developments to have charging stations.
The report says 90% of Austin's carbon emissions come from electricity generation and transportation. Mose Bushell, KUT News.
If you have kids in the Austin Independent School District, this next story is for you because AISD's Board of Trustees has approved the calendar for the 2020 2021 school year. KUT's Claire McInerney explains the details.
The first day of class next school year will be August 18th, and the last day will be May 26th. Thanksgiving break will be 5 days, and winter break will last 12 days, with students coming back on January 5th. Students and staff will be off for Martin Luther King Day, Labor Day, and Memorial Day. There are some parent conference days for elementary schools in the fall and spring semesters, and middle and high schools will use those days for staff development. You can view all of the details of the current and future calendars at austinisd.org/calendar. Claire McInerney, KUT News.
The story of family separation, as largely reported by the media, mostly focuses on immigrant parents who are apprehended at the U.S. border and detained in facilities separate from where their children are kept. But there's another aspect of family separation as it relates to U.S. immigration policy. The Texas Standard's Joy Diaz brings us that.
The story of the Angel family of Central Texas includes a detention, a deportation, a kidnapping, and an illegal return into the United States. As you can imagine, all of that caused a lot of stress and periods of depression. One more thing. We'll be using first names only for this story because of the family's very real fear of another deportation. The dad in this story is Angel.
Angel.
It means angel. That's his real name. He's 29, and he's from Mexico. His wife, Rosie, is 24.
Ella es ciudadana americana.
She's an American, a Texan. And they have three kids.
Tres niños.
All born here. Three little Texans, ages 8, 5, and 2.
The moon. She likes the moons because she wants to be
an I met the kids and Rosie on a foggy morning as they drove to school. Our conversations were a mix of English and Spanish, a common thing for mixed status families. If you're not familiar with the term, mixed status, listen to Dr. William Lopez, a researcher at the University of Michigan School of Public Health.
Mixed status family is a family that varies in immigration statuses, and usually that means an undocumented parent of citizen children.
The mixed status comes with its own stressors. After Rosie drops off the kids, she heads into work. As we drive, she tells me she's the manager of a health clinic in Austin. For his part, Angel supervises a construction crew. He uses a fake ID to work, and that's at the root of his deportation last year, the fake ID. One morning in early 2019, Angel got pulled over. He presented the officer with his fake papers and was immediately detained on immigration charges. When the two oldest children came home from school that day, they learned Dad wasn't coming home. Again, Dr. Lopez.
You can imagine growing up with this fear that every time your dad or your mother drives away, that might be the last time you see them. It's not hard to imagine how damaging that can be for a child psychologically.
To add to it, Angel spent 6 months in detention. The impact to the children was obvious to Angel and Rosie. Visits were through a glass window.
They're all crying because they see him and saying they want to hug him and they can, because you can even touch him.
Then,
me deportaron a México, ¿verdad?
Angel was deported back to Mexico. In 2018, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security removed more than 400,000 people from the United States. Angel's deportation, however, wasn't the end of the story.
Y me secuestraron.
Shortly after being dropped in Nuevo Laredo, Mexico, Angel was kidnapped, a ploy used by many Mexican cartels that's on the rise. They target migrants thought to have relatives in the United States and hold them until ransom is paid. Now, Rosie was not only dealing with the children on her own, she was being harassed by kidnappers who wanted thousands of dollars for Angel's release.
And they told me, we need this, if not, you're not going to see him again.
Rosie drove to Nuevo Laredo, Mexico, to deliver the money.
I was scared. I had my three kids with me that day. So I was just crying and crying like everyone was seeing. I wanted to stop crying, but I couldn't.
The kids couldn't stop crying either. They had spent the entire day in the car. They were hungry, tired.
stressful, most of all. Painful.
Angel knew his wife didn't have enough money, and he got word to her not to pay. Rosie ended up turning the car around and going home, even though she knew her husband could be killed. But that, she told me, was beyond her control. Instead, she tried to focus on what she could control, which was her kids' well-being. When people ask her, why doesn't Angel become a citizen? She has to tell them it's almost impossible because he had originally entered the U.S. illegally. It doesn't matter that he's married to an American or that he has American children. Meanwhile, in Mexico, Angel went through his own ordeal. He escaped his kidnappers and took refuge in a church. From there, he was able to call his boss back in Texas and told him the whole story. He also told his boss he wanted to come home, but he needed money to hire a coyote, a smuggler, to get him back into the U.S.
Ahora anda rondando los $10,000.
It was around $10,000. His boss lent him the money and even promised him his job back if he made it. Rosie couldn't believe it.
It was like I was basically dreaming. It was just unreal.
After the call, Angel was nervous and didn't know what to expect upon his return. Would Rosie still be waiting for him? What if she had met someone else? After all, it had been almost a full year since they had seen each other. They barely talked in that time. But the sound of the church bells calmed him down. They brought memories of their wedding day and of the words their minister said.
Lo que unió Dios no lo separará el hombre.
Let no one separate what God has joined together. It is against the law to cross the border without documentation, but Angel felt no law could separate him from his children. The family is together, again, but not without scars, especially the children.
They've been through a lot. They're not going to forget this.
I'm Joy Diaz for the Texas Standard.
This week marks 1 year since a cyclist was killed when he was hit by a bus on the University of Texas campus. Since then, advocates have called for improvements on San Jacinto Boulevard. But as KUT's Samuel King reports, they're frustrated by what they see as a lack of progress.
Construction on Red River Street has shifted more traffic over to San Jacinto on campus. That, advocates say, is all the more reason for safety improvements along the roadway. They've been pushing for a protected bike lane since the death of Tony Diaz, who was hit by a Cap Metro bus while heading home from work last January. Curtis Rogers is an alternate member of Austin's Bicycle Advisory Council.
Given the amount of traffic that it's pushed over to San Jacinto Boulevard, whether it be traffic from cars or bikes or pedestrians, it's even more the reason that we need to see this change.
The university spokesman says the other nearby road projects are causing too many disruptions to allow significant changes to San Jacinto Boulevard right now, but other improvements have been added, including better crosswalks and signage. The university is also committed to adding protected bike lanes to Red River as part of the road project. Samuel King, KUT News.
New research is calling on municipal courts in Texas to stop leveraging driver license renewals to collect court costs. KUT's Andrew Weber reports.
Texas courts regularly put what's called a hold on people's licenses if they fail to pay fines associated with low-level offenses and fees associated with court operations, meaning they can't renew their licenses when the time comes. A new analysis of court data from Texas Appleseed and Texas Fair Defense found city courts in Dallas and Houston accounted for 63% of the more than 166,000 new holds in large cities in 2018. And the study argues those holds didn't necessarily lead to courts recouping more money. Mary Mergler with Texas Appleseed argues that whole system of suspending license renewals is often burdensome for low-income Texans who may not be able to drive to work or even apply for a job without a license.
In order for them to protect, their most vulnerable residents, people who are
enduring financial hardships and struggling to make ends meet, they can decide to stop participating. They could decide to stop suspending licenses as punishment for not paying fines.
Mergler says city courts in Arlington and Plano, which don't opt into the program, had high collection rates. Statewide, currently 1.1 million people have holds on their licenses under the program. Andrew Weber, KUT News.
A staple of the Austin startup scene is emerging with Station Houston, a similar startup incubator in that city's downtown. As KUT's Jimmy Moss reports, it's all part of the company's shift toward statewide collaboration.
The agreement with Station Houston adds to other partnerships Capital Factory already has in Houston. It opened a Dallas location in 2018. Capital Factory founder Josh Baer says this is part of his statewide strategy for entrepreneurs to tap the potential of other places.
You should treat all of Texas like one big city. You should be recruiting from across the state. You should be raising funding from across the state. And you should be doing business and trying to work with the big companies located across the state.
The company offers office space, networking events, and investment in startup companies. Jimmy Moss, KUT News.
For almost half a century, the Villager newspaper has served as a voice of Austin's African-American community. Publisher Tommy Wyatt has made it happen since 1973 and witnessed a lot of changes along the way. Now, images from the Villager newspaper, pictures that have helped tell the story of Austin's Black community since 1973, are on display at the Austin History Center. The exhibit is called Our Community, Our Voice, photographs from the Villager newspaper. Tommy Wyatt, thank you for coming to KUT.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
We're also joined by someone whose job is to document and curate the African-American narrative of Austin, and that's the Austin History Center's African-American community archivist and librarian, Kimberly Keaton. Hello, Kimberly.
Hello, how are you?
I'm great, thank you. So, Tommy, first, what led you to establish the Villager newspaper back in 1973?
Oh, boy. Well, actually, when I first came to Austin, I was an insurance salesman. I came in 62, and I had never been here before, didn't know anybody in Austin. I got transferred here by the insurance company I worked for. And the way I learned about the citizens here, that was the daily newspaper called the Capital City Argus. It was a weekly newspaper. And each week, they had little paper boys, paper girls who would come around, and they'd bring me a copy of the paper. And that's how I learned about who the citizens were, by reading that paper and what they were doing. And mysteriously one night, the editor of that paper had a heart attack and died playing bridge. You know, and so the community went through a long period of relaxation because the paper was not being produced in the manner in which it had been. And so I started trying to do something about it. Didn't plan to be in the newspaper business officially for a long time, but just get it running again. And I've been doing it ever since.
What has been the guiding philosophy behind the Villager newspaper?
Well, first of all, our paper's free. So you don't have to worry about trying to find a quarter, a dollar, whatever to get it. All you have to do is know where it came from. Our philosophy is we want to put together a historical record of the Black community and the good things about the Black community. In our daily papers, all we can see, you can see when we make the front page is when an African-American has done something bad. Kill somebody or got arrested for whatever, you know, and we want to record the positive thing about African-American community, you know, the 50-year anniversaries and the kids who finished college and the kids who came back to become doctors and whatever. Just positive news about African-American community. We didn't feel you could get it anywhere else.
Is that still something you're confronting today as a challenge?
That is the challenge, you know, because again, with our community moving the way it has, people who lived in area where we first was distributing have to make new homes, new acquaintances. You know, they're not as totally surrogate as they were then, because now they have to move out of Central East Austin into other neighborhoods like Round Rock and Pflugerville in this area. Those communities are integrated these days, you see, and so it's not the same type of thing, but the information is still needed in the same way. And our readership is at least 35-40% non-Black.
Kimberly, you are an archivist, you are a librarian, you study history. How does the Villager newspaper fit into the long history of the African-American press in the United States?
So when I look at the Villinger newspaper, look at the Dallas Weekly, the Fort Worth Black News, the Houston Defender, the one thing that I would say about the Villinger for me is that I think it's a curated newspaper. You actually have the opportunity to curate your own news for your community. I don't see it as a paper where when you send in a press release or you pick up the phone to speak with Mr. Wyatt about what's happening in your community that you're going to be pushed aside. Like, you're important. That's what the Black press has always been about. Sharing and showing that Black people are important, that we have news, we are about news, that our news stands the test of time just as any other person, just as any other sect or community in the United States. In my travels and just looking at Black newspapers and going all the way back to, I would say, the Great Migration, it's one of the reasons why African American people were able to have the opportunity to prevail in the United States.
You know, I want to say another thing, too. One thing our people did, it provided jobs for our community. When I came to Austin, many of the business, many of the employers of the Black community were minority-owned businesses. Many of them had gone to Tuskegee Institute, historically Black College and University, and they came back and hired their own, you know. And one of the big problems was when our kids went off to college, graduated, they didn't always come back to Austin. They went somewhere else where they thought the opportunities were better. Until just recently, I mean, this was not a town that you look forward to to be progressive if you want to be a dentist or physician or whatever. This was not the community that was promoting that, so they'd go away.
I would like to add to that when you look at the Villager newspaper, community newspaper, one thing that Mr. Wyatt prides himself upon that I admire is that he speaks about the goodness of Black people, and that when you look at other newspapers, you won't get to see the debutantes. You won't get to see the straight A students that come from my community being featured weekly. You won't get to see the African-American authors that are local who are making strides within their own community. And that is one of the unique things about his journey, is that he focuses on the goodness, the good things about Black people. And not to say that there are not other things going on, but I think each paper serves what it needs to serve in its time.
Well, and when you talk about building a historical record, how important is the Villager to Austin's?
Oh, when you see these images, when you get to come to this exhibition, Our Community, Our Voice, photographs from the Villager newspaper, I had the opportunity to go through hundreds of photos. And I got to see Mr. Wyatt in so many different angles. Just looking at how he opened the door for African-American people to capture themselves. And then from his eye and how he saw and how he sees the African-American community, I think we should have already dedicated an exhibition to the Villinger. Why did it take so long?
Can't say enough about the Austin Public Library, because it started from day one documenting our stuff. You know, you could go in there and pull us up on the feed anytime, find out what went on. They were the one that preserved all the photographs she's talking about at the Austin History Center. Was done by the Austin Public Library. When they built the new library, and the old library came to the History Center, they were just keeping those documents, and we can't thank them enough for doing that, because we had no place to keep these records.
And they are, they're a plethora of images. You get to see all kinds of different people, like, oh my God, I look like that, and oh Lord Jesus, I didn't even know that was going on back then. Like, it wasn't really like that. Being a 76 baby, and like looking at this, it's just monumental to me. I was just, wow. Like, just Austin was beautiful. Black is beautiful. And I think that's what this paper represents and what it says.
The Austin History Center exhibit, Our Community, Our Voice, photographs from the Villager newspaper, is on display through April 19th. And it's part of the kickoff to the Austin History Center's first ever African-American genealogy conference, Growing Your Roots. Tommy Wyatt is publisher of The Villager. Kimberly Keaton is the Austin History Center's African-American community archivist and librarian. Kimberly, Tommy, Thank you so much for coming to KUT.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That's KUT Weekend for the first weekend of February 2020. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. Email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org, or just ask me on Twitter. I'm @KUTNathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. ¶¶